for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Some call it the war on science, the growing opposition to scientific findings on issues like genetically modified foods, vaccines, and climate change. So why is skepticism about science on the rise? And how can scientists improve communication with those who doubt? Joining me, Dr. Marcia McNutt of the Journal Science and Joel Achenbach of the Washington Post. Joining us from her home in Hawaii, Kathleen Hall Jamison of the University of Pennsylvania. I hope you'll join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Great to be here. And I just want to say it's an honor to be on a show with the great Dr. McNutt with the great Dr. Jamison and Diane Rehm. I should just sit here quietly and take notes.
No, don't you do that, Joel. It's good to have you all here. Joel, you wrote the cover story for the National Geographic titled The War on Science. What inspired you?
That story was one we worked on for a long time. The National Geographic was interested in this topic of why is there so much pushback on things like climate change, vaccines, genetically modified organisms. And so we want to look at the dynamics of disbelief. Why is this the age of contested knowledge? We weren't trying to litigate each of these issues individually, but we were trying to figure out the way polarization happens, why people become so tribal, how they get their information. It's very clear the world of information has changed. There's been a disintegration of the old gatekeepers of knowledge, and now people get their information from the internet. They get from a variety of sources. It's small d democratic information world out there, and they often find exactly what they already believe, and they end up in these echo chambers. So we wanted to explore that.
Marcia McNutt, you are the former director of the U.S. Geological Survey. How do you think things have changed in the last 10 to 15 years regarding our belief system in science?
Well, Diane, I think a number of things have changed. First of all, one thing that's changed is that science is just more in the news. It's more prevalent in terms of decisions that we need to make because we find that our future is much more hinging on using science to find a way forward. To find a way forward for better health, for a better production of food, for our energy future, for whether or not we can actually find a peaceful and sustainable way to have 7 billion people on this planet. So that makes every human being confront their belief system with science in making those decisions. And I don't think that people maybe 30, 40 years ago had that daily confrontation of their belief system with science the same way that people have to do today.
And Kathleen Hall Jamison, I know that there's an emerging field of inquiry looking into exactly how science communicates. Is communication and finding better ways to do it the key here?
It's a key. It's not the key. But understanding how it is that the communication structure works to communicate the increasing access that we have to science through the new media channels is one of the challenges for the scholars who are studying this. Because as science comes into a polarized environment, a polarized political environment, in a media structure in which some of the basic tendencies of media work against communicating scientific consensus. The norm, for example, that suggests that controversies are two-sided. Well, we know that many controversies aren't two-sided. They're multi-sided. But sometimes there isn't actually a controversy. There's actually a consensus, in which case the appropriate news communicates the consensus and doesn't balance with an alternative. It's a real challenge for a media structure that is accustomed to say, he said, she said, here's the assertion, what's the counter-assertion? And as a result, when the scientific community has come to a consensus, there's an underlying tendency in the media community to undermine the consensus inadvertently with its norm of, in this case, false balance.
Joel.
Well, let me jump in as a newspaper reporter and say that it's true what Dr. Jameson is saying, that false balance has been an issue for a long time, issues in which there really aren't two sides.
For example?
Well, evolution, for example. And there's no way you can understand biology without understanding that evolution is a striving element in the whole biological world. But and climate change is probably the biggest example.
If you
Right now, if you have a consensus coming out of a group like the IPCC saying that humans are a significant factor in the observed warming of the last century, you don't necessarily want to then go to someone who says, oh, no, CO2 is not a greenhouse gas. That's not a fair comparison. But I will disagree a little bit. I think that, first of all, for those of us in places like the Washington Post or NPR, I think we've gotten better at the false balance issue of not doing that. But people don't all get their information now from just the New York Times or NPR. They get it from all different kinds of places. I think a bigger problem is when we overemphasize the latest report, the latest outlier study that comes out and allegedly shatters the paradigm.
Okay, but let me take you on a little bit about that. For example, it seems to me that part of the problem is that the nature of science is that it is evolving. Our understanding is evolving and changing. Perfect example, eggs, cholesterol, the connection. For years, we're told, don't eat eggs. Now, we're told eggs are fine. So it creates some doubt in people's minds. Is science really to be believed, or do I simply have to wait for the next study? Marcia.
I think, Diane, you bring up a very good example with that. Scientists are constantly using the best available studies to advance their understanding, and it will be expected that take red wine. Drinking red wine is good for you. Drinking red wine is bad for
right.
you. I've seen flip-flops on that study as well. The important thing is that what the media can do in this case is help people see the caveats behind these studies, to go in with what a responsible journalist might do is say, what was it in this latest study that was different than the previous one? Why did they come to a different conclusion? Was it the amount of eggs? Was it the study group that was being looked at? Was it overall changes in our dietary patterns?
But the problem is, and here's where the disconnect comes, most people don't keep delving. They'll take the headline, they'll take the first paragraph, which says it's okay to eat eggs, and go from there. What I want to know very quickly from you, Joel, is how wide the gap is between science and what people believe in?
I think that something that Marcia said earlier is crucial, that we live in a different kind of world that has a lot more science and technology in it and a lot more risk analysis that is demanded of us. And as we look at the world around us and have to decide, is it safe to have a cell phone tower nearby? Let's say I want to find out the answer to that. I go Google it. And I discover, the first thing I look at is, oh, cell phone towers is going to radiate, it's going to fry your brain, right? And where does that come from? Most people are not scientists. I'm not a scientist. And how do you then delve deeper into it to figure out, is this good information? Is this reliable? Is it credible? And unfortunately, it's harder and harder for us to know on some of these complex questions where to find the best information.
Joel Achenbach, he science reporter for The Washington Post. He wrote the cover story for the March issue of National Geographic titled The War on Science. Short break, right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Denver International Airport is committed to lowering emissions by heating its terminal and fueling hundreds of vehicles with natural gas at thinkaboutit.org. From Citrix with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring HD video conferencing, screen sharing, and meeting recording capabilities. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Talking about a new piece on the cover of the National Geographic written by Washington Post science reporter Joel Achenbach. It's called The War on Science. He's here in the studio along with Dr. Marcia McNutt, editor-in-chief of the journal Science. She's former director of the U.S. Geologic Survey, and by phone and Skype from her home in Hawaii, Kathleen Hull Jamison, professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication, director of the Annenberg Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, I wanted to come back to you because evolution, or the belief therein, seems to be a perfect example, as Joel mentioned earlier. Whether or not you accept it apparently depends on your worldview rather than science. Why should that be?
Our value system is a very strong part of the way in which we perceive and experience the world. And when we hear something that assaults our value system, or that we perceive assaults our value system, the logic of who we are says, that's an attack on me. I'm going to reject that. I'm going to find reasons to dismantle those claims in order to defend who I am. So we get a protective response instead of an accepting response. But in the case of evolution, we've got an interesting case. because some in the scientific community appeared to those in the religious community to be suggesting that evolution and theism were not compatible. And as a result, you had to reject a belief in God in order to accept a belief in evolution. Instead of making the claim that you have to reject the notion that the Earth is a certain thousand numbers of years old, because we have a strong record that suggests, oh, no, it's not, it's much, 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 much older, the larger claim was mistakenly made and heard as being a claim of science. That meant that theists were inclined to reject evolution because they thought it was attacking a fundamental belief in God. The National Academy of Sciences did something very smart when it put out its report on evolution. It quoted theists, people who are prominent scientists who believe in God, who said believing in God and believing in evolution are compatible. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to believe in God to believe in evolution, but it means that they are compatible. Sometimes the voice of science is heard to be attacking basic values, and a community rejects it as a result, rejects the conclusions as a result, when it doesn't need to because the attack need never have been there in the beginning.
Joel, is that what you found as well?
Yes. The research on this issue indicates that people tend to be very tribal, particularly when they feel, as Dr. Jameson just said, that their values are being attacked. And what happens is there's this dynamic of people like me believe this, and people like them believe that. And this doesn't affect every scientific issue or, you know, every scientifically mediated issue, but certain issues do get sucked into that kind of dynamic. And climate change is one where we've seen that happen since the 90s. It gradually became much more of an element in these culture wars and these political wars. And getting back to about the false balance issue, there are certain news organizations, I don't need to mention them, that they're not interested in balance on this. They have an agenda they're driving. So
politics gets into all of this scientific discussion and whether one accepts one study or rejects another depends on your political perspective.
There's a filter right there at the very beginning of it. And so I would like that for the people in the scientific world, like Marcia, to have success in building trust with people. We're not part of some conspiracy to lie to you or to create a false reality. This is how we know what we think we know.
Here's an email from Gerald, and I'll be interested in your reaction. He says, it's not accurate to call the effects of anti-intellectualism in America skepticism. It's ignorance and denialism. Skepticism is reserving judgment until the facts are in. That is the methodology of science. Marcia.
Well, I agree with Jared that science and scientists are trained to be skeptical. That is the hallmark of a good scientist, to look at the study of another scientist with skeptical eyes, to say, is this the only interpretation of the data? What else could it be? And to be constantly questioning.
But if the questioning by non-scientists goes on to create a totally different version, then you've got a problem, Kathleen.
We do, and part of what happens is that basic human cognitive processing comes into play. And we forget that in the equation that the information itself is not what is persuasive. What is persuasive is an individual's capacity to accept it, which is in part a function of whether the individual grants the credibility of the communicating source. To the extent that people trust science in general and a specific area of science in particular, and those organs of science that speak for it, increase the likelihood that they will accept the scientific claims, as long as the voice of science doesn't sound as if it's a partisan voice or an advocacy voice. But if the voice of science starts to sound as if it's a voice of advocacy in a political debate, then our filters as humans, as partisan humans, come to play, and we begin to hear a political debate instead of an attempt to explicate science. And so when you explain, for example, Arctic sea ice change, and NASA is the voice explaining it, NASA is trusted by conservatives and liberals, and the voice of science communicates how it knows clearly and respects the audience enough to let the audience work through the data, you increase the likelihood that even those who ideologically might not be disposed to accept climate science change claims accept the claim. We have to understand how humans process and how credibility plays a role in it, and then use the credibility of science effectively and not risk it by sounding as if science is a partisan voice.
Marcia.
Yes, and I agree entirely with Kathleen that that science needs to be nonpartisan. I think where Jared's question might be going is when skeptics question what science is saying, because they say, in my gut, I don't agree with that, but they're not using the inquiry-based methods of science to test their interpretation of the laws of nature. Let me give a very, very simple example that every school child learns. You go to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and you drop two balls of the same size and the same shape. One is made of pure lead. One is made of balsa wood. They hit the ground at exactly the same moment, even though one is very much heavier than the other. Now, before people even see that experiment, most people's gut reaction tells them that the lead ball is going to hit the ground first. But it doesn't. The law of gravity says they both hit the ground at the same time. And this is the issue with many things in science. What people's gut reaction is not the way nature works. And the example you raised about cholesterol was a perfect example of that. That initially, the gut reaction of many people was that eggs are high in cholesterol. And so if I want to keep my cholesterol down, I should not eat eggs. And so the low-risk path that scientists initially took was to say, to keep your cholesterol down, you should probably avoid high cholesterol foods. But when they looked into the complex pathways by which the body metabolizes cholesterol, they found that there wasn't a link between eating eggs and your body's cholesterol.
Joe.
Just to tie up one loose end, I've gotten a lot of emails, as you can imagine, after this National Geographic story from people on all different kinds of issues where they objected to one element of the story. Maybe they didn't like what we wrote about GMOs or fluoridation. But there are a lot of people correctly point out that skepticism is good. So the word skeptic is not a pejorative. Doubt is good. Doubt is an essential tool in science. So there's a little bit of an issue of what do you call someone on the climate debate who doesn't believe in the consensus mainstream view? Is that a skeptic or a denier? And this is just a question of terminology that we haven't completely resolved.
But the question of what degree of doubt is healthy and how far does it go into the realm of it's my gut that tells me otherwise, which is rejecting of the science.
Well, you don't want to get into a situation where your doubt takes you into pseudoscience and bunk and nonsense and stuff that's just anti-scientific and nutty. I mean, the moon landing was not faked. Those flying saucers out west they're not actually spaceships from another world. They don't really they're not interstellar spacecraft. Someone may call in and argue with us on that point, but there is a slippery slope into pseudoscience and also conspiracy theorizing. I mean, a lot of what I have gotten in the emails that have come in since the National Geographic story ran sort of had this conspiracy theory element to it, which is, well, scientists have to report certain kinds of findings because otherwise Marsha McNutt will not put them in her prestigious journal, or they won't get the funding from the U.S. government, which has some kind of malign agenda. And so I'm getting emails like that. And if you know, down that road lies nihilism and paranoia.
So, Kathleen, the issue of prior belief, the issue of, well, my parents raised me to believe that evolution really did not happen. My parents raised me to know for certain that climate change is not my fault. I mean, these issues come up every single day. How does science at this point overcome that questioning, that ongoing doubt that says, I know better?
Well, first, science needs to be careful that it doesn't assault values when the science, you know, does not require that the value is at issue. And I think in evolution, too often that has been the case, where people have mistaken evolution for an attack on belief in God. But more importantly, I think we need to ensure that when we understand that someone misunderstands something, we put in place the alternative explanation that accounts for the same data in a compelling fashion. The research on how you displace misinformation says that when people have a theory about how something works, you have to displace that with the theory that is the correct theory about how people work, how something works, not simply tell them that they're wrong. And sometimes I think what we say is, no, that's wrong. Everyone agrees that that's wrong, and we forget to take the next step, which is to say, let's explain how it is that we know that this alternative is the more plausible alternative, that it accounts for more of the data, that this theory has predictive power and as a result accounts for X, Y, and Z. So, for example, evolution would predict that we would find certain types of fossils. When scientists find that type of fossil, and you say to an individual who has doubted evolution, you see there's predictive power in the theory. It theorized it would be there. The scientists found it. Here, let's look at it. Here's the fossil. You are making a claim that displaces one kind of belief with another kind of belief without threatening a person's values.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Joel, you know, there is, even within the U.S. Congress, some members who continue to deny that climate change is man-made.
So the other day, Senator Inhofe had a snowball in the Senate chamber, and I guess he was trying to make the point that there can't be climate change because he had a snowball. You know, the climate and weather are different, and a lot of my reaction to the story focused on this issue of people saying they don't believe, they say, in the whole climate change scenario. But when you listen closely to them, many of them accept the actual foundational science of it, which is that CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and we're producing a lot of it. And if you pump a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, you're going to contribute to the warming. And so I think many people actually what they don't like is they don't like the solutions that are thrown out there as like a carbon tax. They might ideologically object to a carbon tax. My job as a reporter, I don't get into like what we ought to do about climate change.
Right.
In the same way that,
right.
So on the GMO issue, I'm not endorsing GMOs, but I wrote, and I stand by it, that there is no evidence that it's unsafe to eat BT corn. That stuff has been studied. There's no reason to think that it's going to hurt you differently from regularly modified corn. It's all been genetically modified either by one technique or another.
But what I'm asking is if a member of Congress stands up and says, there's no global warming. Look at this snowball. Aren't people who are inclined to believe that I don't have an impact on global warming going to take his statement and believe it over the statement of scientists?
I I think on that issue, and Marcia, you jump on here, I think on that issue people have become very, very polarized and tribalized, if that's even a word. And I don't think that what Senator Inhofe said and did changed anyone's mind on this issue. I don't think people are
that
sitting...
those who already believed as he does continued to.
Correct.
And those who believe...
people otherwise thought that it was a silly stunt.
All right, Dan, we're going to take a short break from our conversation with Joel Achenbach, Marcia McNutt, Kathleen Hall Jamieson. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I want to hear your questions, your comments. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that in the application economy, every business is in the software business. CA makes software to empower enterprises and help them thrive. More information is at ca.com. From Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
On the next Fresh Air, Kim Gordon. She co-founded the band Sonic Youth with Thurston Moore. When their marriage broke up, so did the band. She's written a memoir called Girl in Band. We'll talk about being a woman in the post-punk music scene and about searching for a new identity after the end of her marriage and Sonic Youth. Join us.
This is for, and we're back. I have a question here for Kathleen Hall Jamieson from Keegan, who says, should scientists not be policy advocates? Is it reasonable for all scientists to be absent from policy debates? What's your thinking, Kathleen?
When a scientist is explaining the science and trying to increase the likelihood that the public understands the science, it is more effective for the scientist not to be advocating a policy solution than it is to be advocating a policy solution, because the minute you get into the policy solution domain, you increase the likelihood that you're involved in a political debate and the audience hears you as a partisan as opposed to a scientist. Which doesn't mean that individual scientists should not hold policy positions, but rather that if you want to preserve the credibility of science and get the public to hear what it is saying about the science, it is more effective not to try to enact those two roles simultaneously.
All right, and Joel, this for you from Jennifer. We mistrust the dollars behind scientific advancement. Do I trust GMO foods when business is behind the research?
I think it certainly what you ideally would want to have is a sense of where does this information come from? Do we trust the source of this? If Monsanto is funding a study, this is something that as a newspaper reporter, I'm going to want to report that. I want to know where does the money come from. I think we would agree that if it's just generically coming from the Department of Agriculture, it carries less of a potential taint from that source. At the same time, I don't know that you would want to throw away all research that comes from private funding. I mean, for example, there's research I was looking at about effects, environmental effects in the Gulf from the oil spill, which Marsha McNutt knows more about than most people on the planet. And that research was funded by the government, but also by BP, in part because they had to fund the research on the environmental effects. So someone could say, well, I don't believe this result because BP funded it. Well, they were required to, and actually the result showed some dire impacts on marine mammals.
But what about GMOs?
If I can jump in, Science Magazine has very strict disclosure requirements for authors on who they funded, what boards they sit on, who they advise. And our policy is that, for example, they have to disclose, and the reviewers take those disclosures with a grain of salt. So, for example, if we get a paper that comes in from Monsanto that looks at the efficacy and the increase in bushels per acre and the reduction in, for example, pests that might come from Monsanto, perhaps that's more believable than a paper that comes in on the safety of GMOs from Monsanto. That we would prefer to see come in from a more neutral funding source.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. Let's open the phones and go to Mike in Toledo, Ohio. You're on the air.
You guys touched on it a little bit with the cholesterol issue. You know, all you got to do is turn on the TV and you see class action lawsuits everywhere from, you know, everything in the pharmaceutical arsenal being, it doesn't work. And I don't understand where you guys are not getting this, why you don't understand why people don't trust anything. We don't get the papers that you're getting and be able to go through them line by line and say, oh, this is going to work because they did the right research. Well, and I know a lot of the academia-contaminated engineers that I work with, and they don't get it either. You know, they throw something at us and say, here, make it work. And we have to make it work because they can't. So we don't trust academia.
So I think that what you're touching on here is the basic issue of who can you trust? You know, where is the good information? How do you make sense of the world when there's so many competing lines of data and so much contested knowledge? Well, so partly that's my job as a reporter. Hopefully over time you'll see that I'm a credible reporter, and I try to figure out, well, what's the best evidence here? Is this latest study something that's worth reporting? Who is behind this? And as the previous caller said, who's funding it? If it's just something that comes out of Monsanto saying GMOs are safe, yeah, that's less credible than if it's published in the journal Science that Marsha McNutt edits. And this is something that we try to do all the time as science journalists, is to make sense of this to help you figure out how to live your life.
All right, to Tommy in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi there, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I was working at Yale New Haven Hospital some years ago in a research group that had been federally funded for many years when Congress cut research funding across the board and our funding changed to pharmaceutical company private funding, a big part of it. And, of course, the questions that we were looking at also changed. And I think, you know, listening to your other callers and the emails, I think that people want to imagine that their doctor or that scientists, that after all that training, somehow they transcend normal human anxieties and become immune to some of the things that ordinary people worry about. But that's not the case. Scientists are human too, and even if they have tenure, they're still worried about losing their research program. So to think that the degree to which the funding source affects the research that's done, I think cannot be underestimated. And it's one reason to argue for the return of public funding of research. There are a lot of different parts to this, but that's one of them.
All right. Thanks for calling. Kathleen.
One of the things that protects science from the human biases of scientists, and as human scientists or biases are the rest of us, is the scientific process and the norms underlying science that increase the likelihood that if there has been error, whether advertent or inadvertent, that it is detected. And so, for example, when a data set is required to be disclosed so that other people can examine all the underlying data and determine whether or not the finding is able to be replicated, if something has gone wrong in the initial science, it's far more likely to be caught. When we require disclosure of all of the relationships that might have affected the science, the conflict of interest disclosures, we're trying to point to possible problems, and the disclosure of data, the requirement the data sets become open, increases the likelihood that attempts to replicate will occur immediately on a significant finding, and as a result, we will know whether or not there was a problem underlying it. And so the scientific process is an attempt to protect from human foibles. Also, the scientific community is concerned about those factors that constrain and enhance trust. There's going to be a major meeting of the life science folks at the National Academy of Sciences May 5th through 6th. It's open to the public, and life scientists and the public are welcome to register to come. The discussion is going to be about how to understand the constraints and how to enhance trust in science.
I'm sure you will be there,
well,
Joe.
Well, there's a huge issue that Marcia and I have talked about of reproducibility, in particularly in the life sciences, and her journal and other journals are really trying to push for greater transparency in how were these studies done so that other people can replicate them and reproduce them, because it's too often the second time someone tries it, they don't get the same result. That doesn't mean the first one was wrong or that the second one was wrong. It's just there may have been some secret sauce in how the experiment was conducted. And so science is working on making its own systems and its own results more robust.
So if I want to research something and I put it in Google, I'm going to come up with, say, hundreds of different thoughts, ideas, papers. You may have papers that were deemed to have been absolutely wrong, but not yet taken down. So, I mean, how do you know what is the role of the journalist here? How do you sift through everything that's out there and try to present to the public the strongest paper you can?
You follow it back to the source. Where does this come from originally? So if there's a story about a new result saying the Shroud of Turin is a real thing that happened 2,000 years ago because there was an earthquake that somehow imprinted Jesus's image on the shroud. You know, what's the research behind that? And if you tug on that for a while, you'll discover that there's nothing there, that it's pseudoscience. So this is what we have to do as journalists. Where does it come from? And follow it back to the origin.
So you think that your role as a journalist and the role of all science journalists is to follow it to the end. But don't some journalists, aren't they aligned with some political forces as well?
Well, I guess that's true. I think that there are certain ideological or partisan media organizations in today's world that start with the conclusion and then look for affirmation of their political conclusion. I think the dynamic that worries me more right now is that there's such an emphasis on on getting attention. There's such a competitive environment for let's get attention. So the temptation is to write something that's going to get a lot of clicks. I mean, I had a story the other day about space aliens, and got a lot of clicks. It would have gotten more clicks, Diane, if I had put more aliens in it. Okay, they were all hypothetical aliens. I should have had aliens on the moon or on the asteroid belt or Mars.
Why did you write about aliens?
Well, because it's a good story. There's a big debate about should we train. It's a whole other conversation we could do here someday. Should we transmit signals to planets out there and say, hey, here we are, right? But I would have had so many more clicks if I had said that they're probably on Mars right now.
All right, let's go to Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. I just thank you for your show and for this wonderful, wonderful conversation. I'm really enjoying this today.
Good.
I just wanted to make a comment in regards to the general public's acceptance of scientific concepts as they come out and as they emerge. And as a scientist, I am studying science. I feel like I love and loathe it because the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And while that kind of plays on our fear of the unknown. So while I can embrace that and enjoy my curiosity, I think for the general public, sometimes it's just more comfortable to see a familiar face on television agreeing with some sort of concept that you are already familiar with as well. And it's more comforting than learning that you might have been wrong.
That's an interesting point, Marcia.
You know, I agree. And I have to applaud those scientists we do have, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye the Science Guy, the people who are science personalities who go out of their way to be that familiar face on television who help translate science for not people like you, but the general public and make it comfortable for them.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But Kathleen, you are in part blaming scientists themselves for the current rise in skepticism. What do you think they've done wrong and hacked it?
I wouldn't put it as a blame frame, rather as an attempt to find ways to translate what it is that science knows to a public that brings lay logic to the scientific enterprise. And so, for example, when the scientific community talked about global warming, it invited people to see warming as the dominant phenomenon. When the scientific community said, let's frame this instead as climate change, they're still talking about the same phenomenon, they made it easier for you to explain why that snowball and why the East Coast, being overwhelmed in snow is compatible with the scientific theory and not incompatible. The concept of climate change doesn't focus you on the warming per se, because some parts of the country are not necessarily going to warm. There's going to be some cooling in some places, but there's going to be climate change. And if one says climate change is the dominant perspective, then using extreme weather as the way of explaining the snow in one place and the drought in the other invites the scientific community to answer the question, so what is the mechanism that might produce all that snow in Massachusetts while we've got that drought in California? And if your metaphor is a warming metaphor because you focus solely on temperature, the public is less likely to see that what is being explained is actually a change in the climate with things such as rising seas, changes in Arctic sea ice, and changes in patterns of the conveyor belts of the globe as the change, with effects that are going to be different in different places, consequential in different places, and problematic, and as a result, there is a need to address them.
So it sounds as though the mode and the manner of communication are at the heart of the disconnect, Joel.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's a different world now, and we don't have just three television networks at night with Walter Cronkite weighing in. And there are great shows like this one that have a big popular national audience, but we have a fragmented media landscape in general. We've got the internet feeding people into these echo chambers and little rabbit holes, and the age-old confirmation bias kicks in for people. They find what they already believe. And I would just say to people, you know, let's turn down the volume a little bit. Let's ease up a little bit on the tribalism and, the, you know, you believe that, I believe this, and try to follow the best evidence, because we do have a world, as Marcia said at the very beginning, where we've got to figure out how 7 billion people are going to live sustainably on this planet. And there's a lot of tough decisions ahead.
And what are you as a journalist doing to change your own route so you can make a difference?
Mostly I just call it Marcia and ask her to get in Kathleen Hall Jameson. Help me.
All right.
Good sources.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Very interesting discussion. Joel Achenbach, he is a science reporter for The Washington Post. His article, the cover story, The War on Science, appears in the March issue of the National Geographic. Dr. Marcia McNutt is editor-in-chief of the journal Science. Kathleen Hall Jameson, professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication. Thank you all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.